Hi and welcome to the iBuyIMD CEO Dialogue. Today's guest is the CEO of Société Générale, Slawomir Krupa. And here's your host, Jean-François Manzoni.
I'm delighted to speak today with Slawomir Krupa, CEO of Société Générale. Société Générale is one of Europe's leading banking and financial services groups, created in 1864, so 161 years old, 119,000 employees, 62 countries, 26 million clients generating, and these are the 2024 numbers, around 27 billion euro revenues and over 4 billion euro net profits. Market capitalization these days at about 55 billion euros. But it wasn't always like this. When Slawomir Krupa took over as CEO in May 2023, the bank's stock price was even lower than it had been 15 years before, coming out of the GFC. There had been ups, there had been downs, but overall, Société Générale had largely lost favor with investors and was trading at a very significant discount to its major competitors. Under Slawomir's leadership, profits have increased significantly and the stock price has more than tripled, including a spectacular year in 2025, during which the Société Générale stock was the best performer in the French CAC 40 index. Slawomir Krupa was selected as the next CEO in October 2022 and took office officially, as I said, in May 2023. Prior to becoming CEO, he had worked almost his entire career at Société Générale, starting with 8 years at Inspection Générale, followed by increasing responsibilities in the corporate and investment banking division, leading him to become CEO of Société Générale Americas and leader of the global banking and investor solutions business. Slawomir, thank you for making time for us and also for having me today in your head office building.
Thanks for coming, and I'm delighted to have the conversation with you. Thank you very much.
Slawomir, let me start by going back to when you took over as CEO. You had an 8 months period of transition, which is relatively long by corporate standards. And then in September 2023, you announced your new strategy with two major pillars: rebuilding the bank's capital and reducing costs. Please tell us more.
I mean, there are many, many ways of saying the story, right? Of telling the story, of talking about that. The one I usually prefer to choose in terms of analogy, image, whatever, is this idea that we inherited at that point in time a house that had been around for 160 years, serving again customers with a lot of storied achievements throughout the years, but which at that point in time had weak foundations. Okay. And no company, no human endeavor, right, really, but no company can thrive with weak foundations. And I would argue that a bank even less than any other company. And so I really, this was my assessment, arguably different from the previous management. And I decided that we needed to focus first and foremost on that, right? Raising the capital, which meant, so you say we go from 12 to 13 CET1 ratio. You think it's nothing. Well, it's 4 to 5 billion euros, right, of capital increase that, instead of doing it by raising it with investors and diluting the hell out of the ones who stayed with you throughout all these difficult years, in terms of valuation in particular, we chose to do it internally by saving the capital in terms of organic investments of capital into our businesses on the one hand, and then on streamlining our businesses and going through a program of disposals. Mm-hmm. And eventually we managed to raise that capital base and fix the foundations without resorting to diluting shareholders, which I think was a fundamental challenge, and which we chose to handle, we're happy about that and delivered upon.
So I'll come back on the reduction of the cost base in a second, but I want to ask a follow-up question on these disposals. Of course, exposed from the outside, it always looks simple. But the reality is a number of the organizations that you disposed of were subsidiaries, for example, in Africa. And I remember that there was some press that raised questions about it. I'm sure that internally there were people who were profoundly attached to these. So tell us about the resolve or the drive that it takes to make decisions that essentially go against decades of operation.
Listen, in my view, it's the job of a CEO and the board, of course, in terms of validating the CEO proposal if they so decide. But it's our job, right? It's at the heart of what we have to do, right? Of we owe to the company that we're leading, that I'm leading, is to make decisions, right? To come up with a strategy, implement it with resolve, as you said, and just remain guided by what's the interest, the superior interest, so to speak, of the entire company long term, right? And I actually say this often to my team mates and to the leaders of the organization, right? When in doubt, ask yourself, what's the best for the long-term success and sustainability of the company? And then, 9 times out of 10, the answer is very easy. So coming back to your point, yes, it was difficult. You said it. One of the subsidiaries we disposed of in Morocco was with the group for over 100 years. So believe me, we didn't take this decision lightly. I didn't take it lightly. But this was, without a doubt, the right decision for the group, not only today, but in the long term. And the other thing is we also, and I said it publicly, I made it a criterion of how we're going to execute this, is that we would do it in a responsible way. So not selling these assets at stupid prices, not selling them too fast, not selling them to the wrong people, right? But making sure that these people who had been part of our story and these entities, again, sometimes for 100 years, that they had the right future. And arguably, I do believe so, in most cases, a better future with better shareholders for them in this point, at this point in time. So this is what we're trying to do. And so guided by these principles, you just stick with the decision and the facts, right? And the facts. Why we sold each business was a factual, rational process, never driven by emotions or opportunity the wrong way, if you know what I mean.
Now, there's also the reduction of the cost base, which has taken the form of a number of waves of individuals leaving the bank. And I guess, particularly in France, of course, this has led to a certain amount of, press and... How did you decide how fast and how much you can contract an organization?
It's a complex question, and I'm going to try and keep it simple, right? One, the target, right? The overall target is a target in terms of efficiency. And it's really trying to understand what would be a rational and reasonable, realistic step in terms of improving the efficiency, as, for instance, measured by the cost-to-income ratio, right? So we started very high. We said, okay, we're going to try and reach in the next 3 years the cost-to-income point of 60%, which we had not reached in most likely over a decade, if not more. And so you try and design that, of course, looking at what would it take to get there from the point where you're at. And then making that judgment call, right? We decided it would be 60%. And then you, again, simply execute the plan that you designed so that you could reach the target. Now, on the people leaving, I would just want to stress that I'm not a great believer in taking entire teams and just getting rid of people who have experience, who have expertise, who have cultural knowledge of the company, how it works. Okay. What are the rules? What are the ways of working in a particular company? So, as much as we can, and we made it very clear in a recent agreement we signed with the unions that our default position, especially in France, where we have the biggest team, is to try and use attrition as the way to reduce headcount. Because in a big company like ours, there is a lot of attrition, natural attrition, obviously people retiring, people just choosing to have a career elsewhere, and so on and so forth. Why? Because it's less disruptive. Right. It's more efficient in terms of the spend, because obviously when you organize big restructuring plans, it costs a lot of money to have a lot of people leave somewhat indiscriminately, and then having to rehire a whole portion of them because, you know, the wrong people left or they left in the wrong area and so on and so forth. We believe that being much more strategic about managing people's mobility within the banking organization while using attrition to reduce headcount, but again, very systematically, regularly, being extremely precise in terms of hiring and controlling hiring in a very strict manner, is a better mix to achieve good outcomes without wasting money on what is called cost to achieve, the restructuring, right?
That means that I would expect your retraining budget to increase significantly over time?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Retraining budget, processes also to increase mobility, right? And these are processes on both ends. So there's a whole bunch of things that we need to do on the employer side to make mobility more fluid, more easy to activate, so to speak. And on the employee side, we need to make sure that there's intentionality in how they think about their career, but also that the choices that they make or they want to make cannot be completely independent from the needs of the company, right? So we need to find that equilibrium point. It's more subtle, right, than just saying, oh, you go or you come in and whatever, we'll see whatever. It's more subtle, but it's cheaper to execute. And in the end, you keep more of the talent, you keep more of that expertise, etc. And so it's more complex to operate, but in the end, again, back to my earlier point, it's better for the company, right? And so we'll try and do that. And indeed, of course, increasing some of the investment that we want to make in both retraining, and upskilling and the mobility mechanisms themselves.
So stronger capital foundations, lower cost base. Is there a growth dimension, at least in some areas of the bank?
So not only there is a growth dimension, there is growth, right? So if you look at our figures, for instance, for this year, excluding disposals, right, which is a perimeter adjustment, we have grown in the 6-7% area, our revenue line, which is, as you know, in our market, a high number. Right. Right, we are a global bank, but of course anchored in Western Europe, and you know Western Europe's average growth GDP figures, and so you see that something in the 6-7% area is already a high pace of growth. It's not unexpected because you were asking about the strengths that I could play with when I was appointed CEO. One of it is Société Générale knows how to grow, because of the innovation agenda, because of the client relationship management skills, etc. We actually historically have been very good at growing, most likely sometimes too fast and sometimes not taking care enough of some of the infrastructure needed to support that growth. But growth itself is more a strength of the organization. So now that we have, on top of what we already see, more capital to give to businesses to grow organically again, actually, this is going to be part of what's going to support the growth of our net earnings in the next phase.
Understood. Now, one of the areas that has grown significantly is Boursobank, your online bank. Now, that interested me because the growth has been extremely significant. And often over the years, when I looked at organizations where, you know, you have a strong incumbent, And the strong incumbent has also within its perimeter an insurgent. Very often the incumbent ends up restricting the growth of the insurgent, including because sometimes there's a perception that the insurgent is cannibalizing. And so clearly Boursobank is very different from anything else that you guys do, but you've managed to either protected, insulated, or so how have you made sure that it could grow as fast as it has?
So this is another feature of Société Générale, and forever we had this thing culturally that we liked generating internal competition. Okay. So we used to have, for instance, very similar and competing offerings in asset management versus our global markets back in the days 20 years ago. And it was consciously supported by management with some costs, right? All kinds of friction costs, all kinds of sometimes, you know, not entirely rational product offering, whatever. And so I think it's a feature of the company, right? I think we have a reasonably high tolerance for internal competition and for the frictions that go with this. And why? It's intrinsically linked to innovation, right? If you have an innovation DNA and you foster this as a matter of culture and as a matter of real strategic intent for the company, you can't restrict it. You can't say innovation in this space is only allowed here, right? Because you're going to eventually lower the total amount of innovation in your company. And I think this was also another strength of the company, which was out there. And management, in the case of Boursorama back in the days, it was way back, actually, more than 10 years ago, decided, and of course something I supported and I continue to do, that it was better, again, going back to for the group, right, to have this internal competition. We are monitoring constantly how much of that cannibalization happens, and some happen, right? I mean, of course, right? It's a very powerful bank today, Boursorama, and yes, it is taking clients out of Société Générale, legacy network, if I may say so. But the proportion is equivalent to more or less our market share, which more or less on average is 10%. Meaning, as we just acquired in the last 3 years, say roughly almost 5 million clients, you know, 10% of them came from us, but 90% came from our competitors. We're fine with that.
Revolut has, I think, managed to get a banking license later this year. Big competitor for you?
Of course. I already said it publicly a few times. When a player in your market comes with a high ability to attract new clients, with a powerful marketing machine, et cetera, and clearly, right, tells everyone that he's after you, right? Not only us, but after your market, after your clients and prospects, you should always start with, okay, I need to pay attention, right? I need to be humble about what I'm doing well, and we are clearly doing very well in this space so far, but you need to start with the position of trying to understand what's going to happen, and trying to understand what are the success factors of that particular competitor and how you should respond, right?
So how they might attack you.
Yeah, us, and again, us directly or us as the market, right? The banking the retail banking market in France, right? And so you need to be approaching this with humility, because what sometimes, you know, people tend to do is to explain and reassure themselves by explaining why, oh, yeah, but they're different, right? And I could do that about Boursorama. I could say Revolut is a super app with a shallow offering that has, you know, regulatory issues here and there. I read that in the press. So before they become a bank like us, which has 80 billion of assets under administration, out of which 60 billion of deposits, well, it's going to take them some time, right? And the average, they have a fraction in terms of deposit per client versus us, a fraction. Our deposit per clients are in the 10,000 euro area, right? So, which is very high. Theirs are in the low hundreds of euros per client. So I could say, I'm fine. We're not doing the same job. Let them do whatever they want to do. And I'm going to continue to do this thorough, real, full-fledged banking, you know, with a number one spot in terms of client satisfaction, and a great track record at attracting clients. But that is a recipe for disaster down the road, right? So we're paying attention and making sure that we continue to be competing and winning in that competition, especially on the satisfaction side, right? Because in the end, in retail space, in the end, the client satisfaction is what matters most. And we've been, again, achieving a number one position in this space front. In France again.
One last question on the strategy side. Your strategy featured some clear decisions regarding the bank's activities in the energy transition. In particular, there was a reduction of the bank's overall exposure to the fossil fuel sector. There was also the decision to no longer finance new exploration projects for hydrocarbons, and clearly a commitment to increase the support of renewable energy projects. In the meantime, of course, a number of organizations, including a number of banks, have reduced their commitments and their efforts in this area. What led you to take such a clear position?
It's always the same story, right? Almost the same answer when you asked earlier about the resolve, etc. I have a real job, right? I'm not head of communications. I'm not about messaging, etc. I'm running a company which has a significant impact for its clients, right? You said 26 right. million clients. You know, if you add to this the people that work in the companies that the bank or the families of our retail clients, we're talking about tens and tens of millions whose life we influence somehow and impact with the way we do our business. Yeah. That's one thing. But then, of course, you know, SocGen has a 1.5 trillion assets. And so we do impact the world with the financing activities and everything we do as a bank in the global economy, and in particular where we directly bank. So we have that responsibility. And so when you have this responsibility, you need to go back to substance, right? And so the question is, do we have a problem as a human race with global warming? We do, right? Do we, as one of the leading banks in oil and gas for decades, do we have a role to play in terms of supporting the transition, recognizing that we need to go down in fossil fuels at a certain pace, right? Not overnight.
Of course.
And I keep on saying this to people sometimes on the NGO front or whatever who challenge us and saying, you know, you should stop doing this immediately, etc. No, right? No, because there are social implications of some of these decisions. They are, you know, take emerging markets. You know, there's simply, why would they be required by us on the Western side, if you will, of history, to overnight be 100% renewable when it took us, you know, a great number of years to start to realize that we were doing damage to the planet, right? So not overnight, but on the other hand, with resolve, recognizing less fossil fuels, more renewables is the way to go. And because, this is very important, we had some competitors in France who ran big ad campaigns saying, we're out of fossil fuels, which they never did as a business, right? So that's easy, right? But we were a leading bank in the space. Right. So these decisions were extremely important. We had to exit clients with whom we banked for three decades, right? For whom we advised them on new exploration projects, et cetera, and so on and so forth. Sometimes national oil companies, which are important in for the countries they operate for, etc. We had to make all these decisions, and we were willing to do this because it was the right thing to do, and it made sense for us to go this way, to support the transition and gradually exit some of these businesses.
If at the next AGM, a shareholder raises his hand and says, but Mr. Krupa, in the short run, you're costing us some profitability.
So first, I'm going to say it's not true, and I'm going to ask him to look at the numbers.
Okay.
Right? I mean,
we've done very well. Fair enough. Fair enough.
But it's the reality. And that's maybe, you know, we have lots of challenges in banking in terms of regulations, in terms of competition, etc. It's a difficult business, right? And it's a complex business as well in terms of risk management. But we have one upside is when we decide to change something in our focus from a business perspective, we don't have a huge plant somewhere that we need to shut down, et cetera, et cetera. We can move capital very easily, right? In the end, the average duration of most of our book on the corporate and investment banking side, where most of these assets are, is what? Four years, maybe. So in 4 years, I can churn, theoretically, my entire portfolio. So I can make these reallocations easily into other areas which are equally profitable, right? And in the end, the renewable business is also reasonably profitable. And so it was never a profitability topic. It was, what's the right decision? And yes, you referred to this earlier, some level of comfort, some level of emotions, right? When you're banking somebody for 30 years, the banker's in charge, they also have like a relationship that's working, the opportunities that are coming easily their way. You tell them, guys, you need to shift half of your business into something else, into new clients. It's going to be hard, right? It's going to be uncomfortable. But in the end, right, these are good people that are engaged and competent, and they just did it.
Let me move to the organizational side.
Sure.
One of the things that you did is you created an executive committee with a little bit more than 10 people, and that included several external hires. And one of the quotes that I read about you is, il sait très bien s'entourer, which is he is very good at picking people. What makes you good at picking people?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure I am good at picking people. I'm certainly very focused on it, right? Okay. In that it starts there, right? I think it's do I think that this is about the most important decision, not the only one, but the most important decision I can make as a CEO, as a team leader, to make sure that I have the right people around the table? Yes. And so I treat it as such. I treat that with respect. And so I spend time on this. I spend time both thinking about what is it that I'm trying to achieve with the team, what kind of skills do I need, what kind of complementarity also I need, right? Because I don't want the same people around the table who have grown in on the same backyard, think everything is their worldview is the same, et cetera, et cetera. It never works, but even more so in banking, where we manage risks, when we make constantly complex decisions, which require several angles to make sure that you covered basically the whole perspective, right? So, I mean, thinking that this is the most important thing I can do, and then trying to do it right, and then everything, right? Experience, right? I also made horrible decisions in terms of hiring. So after 30 years, you know, I also know how I got played, so to speak, and what are the mistakes that I'm prone to make, right? I also spend a lot of time when I make a mistake, trying to understand, okay, but it's not so much about the mistake. Okay, fine, you know? But why did I make it, right? What was the angle that I didn't see? What did I miss? Yeah. Or what is the bias that I had? And so on and so forth.
One of the things that struck me on the organizational side is you have named co-heads in a number of areas. And this is not unheard of. We have seen co-heads. In fact, we have even seen co-CEOs in a number of organizations. And sometimes it's worked. Sometimes, you know, it hasn't. What do you like about the system, and what needs to happen for it to work?
So maybe one preliminary comment is that I never do it because of political reasons. That would be for me probably the reason some of the co-heading don't work, and the reason some of them work, right? If you make it for political reasons, basically you have two powerful people in your organization,
okay,
that are equally talented or whatever, etc., and you don't want to make the decision which one is going to lead the okay, division or the business or whatever, right? And then you make them co-heads. That always ends badly, right? In my case, it's never that, right? I'm never shying away from a decision and a clear decision. It's more when there is a particular set of circumstances where both individuals have levels of, again, complementarity, potential synergy, but also ability to work together, which, okay, is high, right? And as you've seen probably, I'm not doing it systematically.
Right.
There's nothing ideological about it. But sometimes it's just the right decision because you have two people who are not really going to make it the right way or in the going in the direction that the company wants to go at that point in time alone. But together, they can really thrive. And this is the logic of the decision. But it's always very carefully considered. And also, I mean, if I can, you know, share a secret, is they always get the brief, which is none of you is going to be the boss of the other, right? If this doesn't work, you're both gone.
Out. Okay. Interesting.
And which also pacifies everything, the slight willingness that would have
just
been there.
Just in case one of you wants to compete.
Just in case, right? This is not what's going on here, right? And so that,
yeah. So complementarity of skills and interpersonal compatibility.
Oh, definitely. They need to trust each other. They need to be compatible. That's essential.
Another big decision you made on the organizational front is essentially renouncing the previous agreement on teleworking, which enabled employees to work, I think, up to 3 days a week from home. And basically, you've said, guys, it's going to be 1 day a week maximum, and if that, in some cases, it might be zero. Clearly, that led to some significant friction with unions. I'm sure you knew it would. But then it means that you made that decision consciously, knowing that it would be a decision that creates friction. Why was it so important for you?
It was extremely important for a number of reasons. I'm going to try and share a few, right? First, it's about the value chain of our business at its core, meaning we have clients who may or may not work from home at a particular moment in time, but clearly they don't choose to work from home or whatever when we work from home, and you can have all kinds of situations with the clients. And the first thing starts there. We need to be there for our clients. Guess what? Okay. Most of the people working with clients in our company had 0 to 1 day per month. So you're in a client business, because we're in a client business, service business, right, where this is the heart of what we do, right? The quality of the service we deliver, the quality of the products we deliver to clients is the beginning of our value chain. And I felt, and the leadership team felt, that having this dichotomy between those who serve our clients and basically the head office, the operations, etc., some of the tech teams, having a completely different working organization was not achieving high efficiency, right? That a lot of frictions arose from that difference in work and organization, and on some level in the way people participated in the common life of the company. So let me move to my second point, right? I do believe that at an individual level, you know, you're not participating in the processes and in the management of the company, in creating the value, in delivering whatever is it your responsibility to deliver in the company, if you're, you know, half here, half there. Example, you have a meeting and you have five people live at the company's premises and five on the video. In my experience, and unfortunately, I still attend too many meetings, I'm working on it, but still, the ones who are on video, they're not there. They're not participating in the meeting. Yeah. And frankly, even when I'm remote, which happens when I travel or whatever to these meetings, even I, and listen, when I speak, you know, by the nature of my position, people tend to kind of stop their chatter and then listen a little more. Even for me, it's difficult, right? And it's normal. It's physical, right? You have five people here who can play on their nonverbal little signs and everything, etc. And you have five people, you know, separate someplace else, right? This just simply practically doesn't work, because we all experience this, right? We all know that. And then again, this balance between the teams, right? So the ones having a little bit like, remember, during the COVID, some people who had to be out there, etc. Yeah. And the others who have a much better deal from that perspective, or perceived it as a much better deal, right? This is also something which I didn't like about the
system.
There
is an unfairness about this.
And for the last comment, for the people themselves, right? You have all the energy and all what's happening in the physical meeting, but also 5 minutes before, 5 minutes after.
Yeah.
You know that, right? This is where a lot of things happen. Also, about that meeting, about that decision, about that topic or whatever, there's that last thing that you want to add or whatever, but also the chemistry between the people, right? And in the end, it serves career, it serves onboarding of young people, it serves personal development, etc. So I think everybody's going to be, in the end, better off. Now, does that create friction and logistical issues for people who have made, you know, sometimes big decisions about their own personal logistics? Yes. But again, you know, it's about the good of the common good of the company. And long term, that's what matters.
Slavomir, as you know, I'm a leadership professor. I have to ask you a few more personal questions. One of them is, born in Bulgaria, moved to Poland, and then to France, age 7. Excelled in school, and enrolled at Sciences Po, one of France's most elite universities. I want to come back to Sciences Po in a minute, but first, how did this immigrant story shape you as a leader today?
I mean, of course, in many, many ways, but if I had to pick two, For instance, one, I think, is the idea that, you know, things that seem impossible are actually possible.
Okay.
So that's the most important to me. This very early on instilled the sense of, I mean, it's about seizing the opportunities. All kinds of things can happen that at a certain point seem completely improbable, right? Because again, for that boy to be in my position right now here, back then, it would have been an absurd idea, right? To even state. And the second thing, I guess, the multicultural background, right? I mean, being able to, also because I left late enough to speak Polish like a Polish person, fluently without an accent, etc. Understanding, knowing, having a deep connection to that culture, that history, etc. And at the same time, having the opportunity through school in particular, and for living here, to develop the same thing in a completely different a country with a completely different history, etc. And so this, from an adaptation capacity, openness, I guess, was a very, very strong and valuable input of these circumstances of mine.
Regarding your Sciences Po experience, you've said something that resonated with me very powerfully, especially in today's age, which is sometimes described as the age of outrage, you know, where there's so much negative emotions so quickly. You've said, one of the things I learned at Sciences Po is that all situations have multiple angles, and it's important to force oneself to see and consider these angles. How do you still do that to this day? How do you force yourself to decenter and look through
another lens? I don't have to force myself because I've been doing this my entire life. And again, there is always a historical perspective to this. There's a psychological perspective to this. There's a macroeconomical perspective to this, and so on and so forth, right? You just said it, sharing that quote of mine. Thank you. There is always multiple angles to any situation, right? And so it's for me a conviction, a belief, but also a technique, right? And so how do I do it? Is by one, by listening, right? And being sensitive to all kinds of signs. So I can talk to you about a meeting I had about annual compensation reviews for some businesses. And I came into the meeting with a certain view, right? A strong view about something. Which I maintained forcefully throughout the meeting, yet there was, you know, reasonably strong opposition to my view, right? And so during the meeting, I wasn't really convinced. You know, I said, we'll stick with my view. I laid out my arguments, et cetera, et cetera. But then getting out of the meeting, I told myself, well, so these people don't think like I do, right? So why don't I try and put myself in their shoes and understand how they are looking at this situation? Right? And eventually by doing just this, right? Genuinely, right? Not for shows.
Right.
Not for shows. Genuinely alone in your office or whatever. You don't have to, again, not for shows. Genuinely ask yourself, okay, hold on. What is the perspective that they have and what am I missing in mind from theirs?
What do they see that I don't see?
Exactly. And in this particular case, I actually changed my view and the line on theirs, actually exceeding their expectations. From there, where they sat, because I saw what they were seeing, and which I wasn't.
So it is still an occasion, an effort, or I don't want to call it a technique, but something that you do consciously.
Definitely.
One of the other things that I heard you talk about is your passion for customers, and I thought that was quite moving. You said, "We're here to help customers have a positive impact on their organization and on society. We are a humble enabler and a foundation for our clients' genius. Our customers are the real heroes of our lives." I honestly haven't heard a large number of CEOs say something like this.
This is what I believe, and it's really rooted in my experience first. So in the emotions that I had serving customers, supporting big projects and trying to help them make it happen. So it starts there, right? Raw emotions and experience. And then, you know, when you think about our job, this is exactly what we're doing. This is exactly what we're doing. And SocGen in particular, many of our peers, but we in particular, I gave you a few examples, but we actually came up with solutions for people to be able to do incredible things. We supported many companies here in France, but elsewhere. Still today, people are telling me the story. My father walked through your door when he was 18, 100 years ago. Not my father, then probably the grandfather. And this is how it started. And now I'm a global leader, right? I have a company that is a global leader in its field. And you made that happen, right? Your generations of bankers who supported us through ups and downs understood our business and were willing, again, right, to make that guy's and his family's genius, deliver the outcome that they had to deliver to the world, right? So that's the most important thing we do. That's the meaning that I have in my life as a banker.
In some articles about you, they mention your active involvement in fixing some of the problems that Société Générale was facing, including the 2012 euro crisis, the 2016 difficulties with the euro regulators. One person said of you, c'est l'homme des missions compliquées. He's the guy that takes care of complicated missions. Was this a conscious decision on your part, or did it just happen that some, on a number of occasions, I guess you must raise your hand in some way, shape, or form?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's two things, right? There is something in me as a person, I think it's part of my personality, of who I am, that I like to do the difficult things, right? I like when it's difficult, I like when it's risky, probably because it also pushes me to do my best, right? Fast and outcome-focused, et cetera, I guess so. So I like these situations. I like these situations, especially when they seem a little bit impossible. And then, a couple of times I just raised my, especially at the beginning, right, to start that pattern that you described.
Right.
I did raise my hand, right? And I remember this very, very vividly in one particular situation where I told myself, a lot of what happened next in my life was depending on that one moment where I could have said, okay, we have this problem, just deal with this, right? This is not my problem, right? And I actually said the opposite. I said, you know what? I'm going to deal with this problem for you. And I think this moment decided a bit about my professional career.
Right. There's so many folks starting to work at the bank. At some point, something needs to put them on the radar screen of the powers that be.
Yeah. Right.
Now, you're described in many media as very honest, unpolitical. I say what I do. I do what I say. You're also described as pretty intense, borderline tough guy. How do you think of yourself as a leader? If I started working for you, what would you tell me early on in our relationship to help me be successful with you?
I would tell you that, we're here not to beat around the bush or not for other reasons than to do our jobs, right? I like to be clear about why we're here, right? We're in this company, maybe we have fun while doing this. Maybe we build lifelong friendships. Maybe we have a good time. Maybe this or that. Maybe we learn. Maybe we develop ourselves. Hopefully we do all these things, right? But doing our job, right? Okay. That's why I'm here, right? When I come in the office in the morning, I'm not here to be the CEO, to feel good about myself. I'm here to do my job for the good of the company, right? So we need to start with that. Okay. Right? There's a lot of implicit things in what I'm saying here, but we need to start with that. And then I'm going to tell you, right, please come, step up, put your thoughts, your emotions, your desires, your energy on the table, right? But come prepared, right? This is not primary school, right? Again, we have a job to do. So if you want to challenge me, etc., do your job first. And if you have done your job first, you'll be surprised how much I'm going to listen to you, even if you're young, inexperienced, or whatever, and how much attention I will pay to whatever you have to say, right? But if you come, right, not knowing your basic numbers, and you're going to try and speak up without putting the work in, then it's going to be tough, right? And when people sometimes talk about my being brutal or whatever, it's never, emotion, it's never about the person, right? I have always 100% respect for the human being, right? I always talk about work, like the work that needs to be done, that should have been done, etc. But then when I talk about that, I have zero filter, right? If your work is not good, I'm going to tell you, your work is not good, right? So you may say it's brutal, right? Maybe you would have liked that I take, 10 minutes to go beat around the bush before you maybe understand that your work is not, but we don't have time for this, right? So that's the only thing. It's very simple. Just let's all do our jobs well and everything's going to be fine.
Let me take you back to September 2023. You've spent 8 months ramping up to the CEO position, an additional 4 months to work out the strategy. You present the strategy and the stock drops 12%, which in part is a correction for progress that it had made in anticipation of your strategy. But nonetheless, on the day, the stock goes down 12%. That can be easy for a new CEO. What went through your mind and through your heart at that time? How do you deal with something like this?
I mean, the first point, and to some extent, it's a thread in our conversation, right? You need to do the job, do the work based on facts with the least emotions that you can, right? Meaning not ignoring emotions, not ignoring, for instance, that a minus 12 is going to have, all kinds of emotions going up in your company, with your clients, with the press, with whatever, right? But doing your job based on facts, a rational thinking process, etc. Meaning, the board asked me on Friday when they were validating the final documents, the final options, etc., targets and everything, what do you think that stock is gonna do on Monday, right? And I told them minus 10. And what happened is minus 12 in a market which was down minus 2. I'm not saying that I was so good at figuring out the minus 10.
But
what
you
I'm trying
were
to say
in the
is,
range.
Yeah. Why? Because we were telling people we're going to slow down growth, we're going to cut the distribution in a very significant way. And analysts and investors, of course, understood that it was a 50% cut in distribution and so forth, right? And so we knew, right? But on the other hand, we also knew that this is what needed to be done. And as I'm sure you have noticed, between then and now, nothing has happened than us doing exactly what we said we would do then and delivering on the promises.
So at the time, you say to yourself, it's normal. They're underestimating the long-term potential.
No. You have to always never go into emotions, right? You have to respect whatever people feel at that point in time. I'm not talking about the hedge funds, but the real investors who are also kind of potentially puzzled or whatever. What I knew is that the signal that was really sent was, well, maybe if you do this, it would be great, but we're not sure you're going to do this, right?
Okay.
Because of what you said earlier. Because of 15 years of us, of the ups and downs, and also not delivering on promises, which was a big thing for
right.
me, right? Deliver, hopefully over-deliver a little on the promises we were making. So what I took was not, oh, they are misunderstand or underestimate the strategy or us. It was show us that you're going to do it, right? So that was the message I took, which...
May 2024, 1 year later... Little movement on the stock price, a little, but one headline reads, the Krupa magic is not working yet. Does it ever bother you? Or do you, as you say, look, I stay focused. I know that we're doing the right things. How do you deal with this external pressure, negative feedback?
So listen, I mean, when I joined as a CEO, when meeting clients or peers, CEOs, I always ask them, so what's your advice, right? What is the advice you want to give? I'm a young CEO. I mean, young as in new CEO. What's the advice that you want to give me, right? And I got a lot of advice, but on this particular front, I got two from very, very prominent bank CEOs. One said, don't ever read what's written about you.
Okay.
There's no point, and so don't ever read these kind of things, right? Of course, analyst reports, that's different, right? But these kind of press headlines and stuff like that, right? And the other said something more nuanced. He said, don't ever believe what they write about you. You're never as good as they think you are, and you're never as bad as they think you are.
Okay.
Right? Which that's one part. But more seriously, somewhat, I guess. Again, I was still of the view that it was to some extent true that not so much the magic, but that we were not there yet, right? So if we're not there yet, it's a legitimate headline, right? And they put the flowers they want around it, right? But yeah, we had not delivered, right? We were right in the middle or closer to the beginning of what we had to do. And yeah, I mean, this was a fair assessment. You know, we're not there yet.
Do you ever doubt yourself?
Constantly. Constantly, right? But literally every day, right? I go through my day and most of the meetings and things I've said, I've done, I decided, I refuse to decide, I'm procrastinating on, etc. And I try to figure out, you know, how can I do better the next day.
But that's not doubting, that's reflecting. And I had a quote of you where you say, I challenge myself at the end of every day, I go over the day and ask myself, why could I have done better?
Okay, fair enough. But I still doubt myself all the time. But I actually came across a little lithography in a shop in Montreal, which said, "Trust your doubts."
Interesting.
Which I loved as a quote and kept with me. Yeah. That you should trust more your doubts than the things that you're certain of. Right? You're gonna discover more and make your certitudes and other beliefs more accurate, most likely stronger or more true, if you actually trust the doubts that you have about them, right? And so I do this all the time. Now, if your question, and I know it is very specific, for instance, on that plan in 2024, you know, it's not delivering yet. The point is, I sit down, I say, okay, I mean, is the idea of fixing the foundation of the bank by having a higher level of capital the right one? Yes. But I'm going to give you one more information, which is not only because I say so, right? Maybe this is the missing piece. I also spent during my transition a fair amount of time speaking with investors and all kinds of other stakeholders, trying to understand how they viewed us, again, in a completely listening mode, right? So I offered in some form of a reverse roadshow, I offered to investors, I said, I can come, I can't say anything, I'm not even in charge.
Right.
So don't ask me questions.
But I'm happy to listen.
But I'm happy to listen to you. All of them said, I want you to come and to listen to me. Which is not the normal, as you know, this is not how the roadshow works, right? The roadshow is, these are my questions, here are my answers, right? You know what I mean, as a CEO. So it was an unusual exercise for them, but they all said yes. And I also gathered a lot of insights from that. Now, I saw, I think, 30 investors or something like that and prospects. Of course, they don't agree, right? There's a lot of things that they don't agree on. But if you take all that raw material, your own experience, your own vision, etc., and you gather all these facts, you work, right? Back to my point, you know, you do your job, right? Thinking about this deeply, then, you know, in 24, when I'm in the beginning, or let's say closer to the middle, but still not there yet in delivery, I know that I'm not doing something I came up with in one morning in a eureka moment in my shower, right? I know that this whole strategy and the intentions that we were fulfilling here came from hard work, right. Insights that were true insights that we gathered, and that made sense, right? And so,
going back to basics, has anything changed in my diagnostic? Nothing has changed in my diagnostic. Keep up the good work.
Yes, and then the last piece, which is important, is you need to be accountable. So bear with me. You need to be accountable for what you're doing. So the other input into my state of mind at the time is, and if I'm wrong, I said to the investors during the CMD, I'm going to be accountable for what's going to happen here. I told them I had one slide about accountability, and I told them, if we don't deliver, there's only one person responsible for this, and it's me. No one else. And that's the final portion of the circle, if you will, right? I'm doing what I believe is the right. I came up with that not through hints, but through hard work, right? And I'm just doing it the best I can. And, you know, if for some reason this was really the wrong path and I really got it wrong, well, I know what I have to do.
This is my last question. I got through this discussion and a considerable sense on your part of personal responsibility. Definitely. Responsibility to the organization, to its history, to its legacy, to some extent to society as well. And you've said, you know, I'm showing up, I do the work. Do you still have fun once in a while? Do you enjoy the job, or is this really what we would call in French a sacerdoce? You know, where basically I've agreed to take on the mantle, I'm wearing the mantle, I wear it graciously, but fun, no, not really.
No, I do have fun every day. I mean, maybe not the same kind of fun that, you know, another person, but what we're doing is fascinating because, again, of what the banker does for his clients, that's one. Two, because of what we're doing with the firm, right? We're transforming it profoundly. And you said it, right? I actually often say this to the teams, also with a view about our own legacy as a generation, right? This thing has been run by generations after generations of people who have done a great job, right? Maintaining it. You said you talked about my predecessor. I mean, he's gone through unbelievable, right? Headwinds and issues. And he had this part to do, right? To go through these difficult times, and he did, right? And sometimes really against the odds, right? And so our role this time around for this generation is to take it from where we got it and leave it better. And I do have a great sense of, I mean, fun doing that, right? And responsibility. And lastly, I do thrive on responsibility, right? I mean, I like the idea that a lot of things is
you.
Exactly that the buck stops with me, and I thrive on that. That's part of the fun for me.
Fascinating, Slavomir. Thank you very much. Really enjoyed this conversation.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. You too.
If you enjoyed this conversation, subscribe to iBuyIMD on your favorite podcast platform. iBuyIMD is brought to you by the Institute for Management Development. Find out more at imd.org. See you soon.